Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening and welcome to The Body Politic. I'm Peter Gurevich. Tonight, as we head into the home stretch of this momentous campaign year, we'll talk with three experts, one on the economy and two on politics, about the issues voters will consider as they make their final choices. We'll get to the national race in a moment, but first, a briefing for California on the important propositions on our ballot this year. For that, we turn to Thad Kauser, an associate professor of political science at UC San Diego and author of Term Limits and the Dismantling of State Legislative Professionalism. Welcome, Thad.
Thanks, Peter.
So this is a fascinating thing. I always find when I talk to foreigners and or even people in the rest of the country about our ballot, these enormous booklets we get about the campaign, there are all these propositions, and we have really hot ones this year. And let's start with two of the most controversial. How about the gay marriage ones? What are your thoughts on that? Who's for it? Who's against it? Where's the money coming from? All those issues.
Yeah. Right. Well, Proposition 8, in this long ballot with another 12 initiatives, this is actually about as short as and simple and clear as an initiative as you'll ever see it. It defines marriage as between a man and a woman and puts that in the Constitution. This is the issue that Californians know most about, care most about this year, and have certainly heard the most about in television commercials. It's also an issue where we've seen an amazing transformation in public opinion over the last 10 years. You know, a decade ago, 70% of Californians opposed gay marriage. That has just gone down and down and down and crossed about the 50% threshold at the same time that our Supreme Court this spring overruled a statutory ban on gay marriage, allowing same-sex couples to marry in California.
Well, what are your thoughts on why has that opinion changed? I mean, why have we gone from such opposition 10, 15 years ago to this? Why is the public changing?
Well, I think it's both a generational shift in views of the acceptability of homosexual lifestyles. We see a huge shift. Senior citizens versus youth voters are almost diametrically opposed on different sides of this issue. And so as more people who've come up in an era more accepting of gay marriage have grown up and become voters, we've seen a change in opinion. And it's also been one of experience with many churches allowing gay marriage, domestic partnerships allowed at the state level, and we've had experience and a lot of people have grown more accepting of this over time.
Yeah, one idea I heard is that most people know somebody who's gay and so they're not terribly shocked by it and it calms them down. So is this a little bit like race, that there's a generational change as the population moves through, there changes in attitude?
Absolutely, but as we've seen on some racial issues, it doesn't always move inexorably in one direction, and in fact, it looked for a while like this initiative was very likely to lose. There's been one recent poll showing that it may win, and even if liberal California puts the brakes on gay marriage, this could be a real block for the gay rights movement nationally. We've seen tremendous interest in this on both sides, but the yes on 8 side has actually probably raised more grassroots money than any initiative we've seen in California. They've raised $25 million, not from some big corporate sponsors, but from enough small donors that actually last Friday they crashed the Secretary of State's computer when they tried to file their campaign finance report just because they had so many donations. There's so much passion on this issue.
Let's talk about another one, which is parental notification. That's a pretty controversial. What are your thoughts on that one?
Well, this is could be the surprise, I think, of this election. Proposition 4 requires parental notification of abortion for a minor. And we've seen, if this sounds like a rerun, that's because we've seen the same initiative in 2005 and 2006. It's lost narrowly both of those times. This year, the third time could be a charm because I think there's so much excitement about Proposition 8, especially in conservative religious groups. There's also a lot of excitement among social conservatives about Sarah Palin. I don't think that's going to be enough to swing the state for McCain-Palin. I don't think that's going to be enough to pass Proposition 8. But that mobilization on the right may be enough to pass Proposition 4 requiring parental notification.
Is that another one of these where it's small people? Are there big lobbies and organizations involved in that one?
On this one, there are a few wealthy individuals who have been the primary sponsors of this, and then the No campaign has generally come from Planned Parenthood and other groups.
So voters are quite capable of splitting the ticket. They could vote for Obama, but they could vote in the other way on this one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. A lot of these get closer to the middle.
Closer to the middle on that. Well, let's look at the other ones. What about the energy propositions 7 and 10? What are your thoughts there?
7 in 10, it's an anomaly. In this year, we have two apparently environmental initiatives that are both opposed by all the major environmental groups in California. So the Sierra Club and the League of Conservation Voters, they're both urging a no vote on 7 and 10. But there are some environmental arguments that could be made for each of those. So Proposition 7 says that both public and private utility companies need to increase the amount of electricity that they buy from alternative sources, the wind and solar sources that we've heard so much about in this presidential campaign, and increases that number, 20% in 2012, up to 50% eventually. They're already under some requirements, and basically the environmental groups that have negotiated these current requirements like the deal that we have right now better, think that this will lead to fewer greenhouse gases than Proposition 7. Proposition 10 is a $5 billion bond to pay for some purchase of alternative electricity, but mostly for changing rebates to consumers to buy hybrids, electric vehicles, and especially natural gas vehicles. The no side has emphasized that it's been backed mostly by Texas oilman T. Boone Pickens, who happens to sell a lot of natural gas and might benefit from this. But there would certainly be some benefits from getting a lot of dirty diesel trucks off the road and replacing them with fleets of natural gas trucks.
So this is a case where if you read it, you might think that this sounds environmental, but the environmental groups are opposed. So
Right. And basically, most of the major newspapers in California have opposed both of these initiatives. They look to be going down in the polls, but it's a tough vote.
Tough vote.
They sound quite good.
How about redistricting? That's number 11.
Right. So Proposition 11 would change the redistricting for just the state legislature. Doesn't touch Congress, but just the state assembly and state Senate. Currently, the members of those houses, every 10 years, get together. Republicans and Democrats fight over it, and they draw their districts. And if they deadlock, it goes to the state Supreme Court. This would take that redistricting out of the hands of the legislature, put it in the hands of a commission of ordinary voters. So anyone who's registered to vote could apply for this commission. They wouldn't be allowed in if they'd run for office, had ties to major interest groups. There's some questions over sort of how much information these normal folks might have. They would certainly be aided by staff. And they'd have to then come to an agreement across party lines with many Democrats, many Republicans, and many independents agreeing on it. And again, if they don't agree, it'll go to the state Supreme Court.
So tell me something about how people, well, these are confusing. This is a classic issue. You study this, so many of our colleagues here do. You face these things as bewildering. As you say, I'm an environmentalist, but it's confusing. How do people make decisions on these? What do we know? How can a voter make a decision about what they ought to do on these?
Well, what we've seen, there's good news and bad news. So about a third of people on many of these initiatives actually really read through the ballot statement, look at the pros and cons, know what's going on with an initiative, and they use that to inform their vote. Another third of the people, they don't really know exactly what's going on in the initiative, but they say, wait a minute, I can follow the cues of some leader I respect. You know, if Arnold Schwarzenegger says yes on this, I know I'm a yes, or maybe I know I'm a no, or you follow your newspaper, an interest group you're involved in. And about a third of the people can, by following those cues, sort of make a vote that fits with their interest. And another third of the people are just sort of trying to figure it out.
So the message is, look for the endorsements, right? Okay, great.
It can be helpful.
Well, thank you, Thad. It was very interesting. Next up, the closing days of the McCain-Obama-Palin-Biden drama that has kept us riveted for much of 2008. In all of the twists and turns of this two-year campaign for president, very few expected that one candidate would be up by 5 to 10 points just 2 weeks before the election, especially given the nail-biters of Bush-Gore in 2000 and Bush-Kerry in 2004. But here we are, with Senator Obama leading Senator McCain by a healthy margin in all of the major polls. And yet, there is lots of uncertainty about new voters, about race and gender, and about the economic turmoil of the past few weeks. So will today's polls last till November 4th? Here to survey the landscape are James Hamilton, a professor of economics at UC San Diego, and co-author of the blog Econ Browser at econbrowser.com. Also with us, Ronnie Schreiber, an associate professor of political science at San Diego State University, and author of Writing Feminism, Conservative Women in American Politics. Welcome to both of you and joining Thad here. So the economy is the tremendously big news of the past few weeks, or maybe for the last couple of years. And there's been this tremendous discussion about the rescue package, bailout package, whatever the words are, the words matter, and how people respond. Start talking to us about it. How come we've had this movement from one plan to another plan to what are, and to the actual practice of what's happening now?
Well, the economic situation has deteriorated pretty quickly the last couple of months, and the financial situation became very severe more quickly, I think, than they were anticipating in Washington. So very abruptly, the Secretary of the Treasury came up with his proposal, which was initially a very sparse document, very vague, leaving a lot of discretion to the Treasury. And there's some reasons for that. We need to act quickly. And we need to act with confidentiality. You can't announce in 2 weeks we're going to take over company XYZ. That would be a disaster to run it that way. But Congress reasonably balked at that proposal and insisted on some more oversight, which is part of what we have in the package they're now trying to operate on.
Well, how did markets react to those? I mean, there are two variables here. What's the political response? Why did Congress object? The other is, how did markets interpret these behaviors?
Well, they really have a life of their own at the moment, and it's moving so quickly that it can look like things have calmed down 1 minute, and 24 hours we're back in crisis mode. I think there's some real stresses internationally, and you see those in any indicator you look at. So I don't think we can say, well, this was just a matter of psychology and everybody calmed down. You did see some initial reactions as the debate was ebbing and flowing, but there's some real issues here which go beyond psychology.
Well, say some more about that, because one of the things I've read is that the administration resisted going to where it now seems to be going, which is something to what they call the British plan or the Swedish plan, depending on how you date it. And one argument I've read is that one of the reasons that they've moved to this is that there was a threat that money would leave the country. They were doing this in Europe, and markets were sort of telling you, you've got to get with the ticket. You've got to do what the other people are doing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as far as the specific details of the plan, that was also something Congress insisted on, that there be some equity acquisition by the Treasury. And there's some good arguments for that in that you get some leverage out of that. If you have more equity, you have more ability to borrow, and the banks can perhaps do a better job of stepping into this crisis. So that was a measure that, again, the original proposal had so much discretion. I suppose Paulson could have done that originally. Right. Maybe he would have evolved to that way of thinking, but now he's basically forced to by the situation. So that's the.
But again, I want you to clarify a little. You're saying the situation is political pressure from Congress, or the situation is market pressure that the other countries are doing something that we're not?
Well, there's been amazing international coordination here between the central banks of the U.S. and much of the rest of the world, which is pretty remarkable how coordinated everybody's action was, and it had to be. But I think the specific details of exactly how you're going to implement this bailout or rescue or whatever you call it have been evolving by the day and by the contingency. So I do know that the legislation requires the Treasury to do the kind of thing they're doing now, which is acquiring stock in the companies, in institutions they're helping. Mm-hmm. Now, whether they would have stumbled into that on their own, what the details of what they implemented without that mandate would be, I have a hard time speculating. Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to broaden this out a little bit and draw other people into the discussion about this. And Ronnie, I'm going to turn to you and say, well, one of the things that's been talked a lot in the past about is the gender gap.
Right.
And one of the people tried to explain it, our colleagues, why is the gender gap exist? And one of the explanations is that women care more about the economy, women are more vulnerable in the economy, and so they kind of respond to these health insurance, stuff like that, that the Democrats think about. Would you say about that? Is there any evidence of that? Do we have any evidence of how women are responding to the crisis that Jim's talking about?
There's definitely evidence of the gender gap, and the gender gap but generally refers to the fact that women tend to vote more for Democratic candidates, presidential candidates, than Republican, and that there are gender gaps on the salience of issues, and the economy is one of them, healthcare mm-hmm. is another, mm-hmm. in part because women are the ones that tend to actually deal with the household budgets, they deal with healthcare for their families, and so on. So there's definitely consistent evidence for the gender gap on those issues. I haven't seen any specific polling so far on how the women are responding to the specific economic plans of either candidate, but I have seen recent polling on women and the election, and there's certainly a gender gap right now that exists where I think it's at least 8 points in one of the polls. One of the polls actually had it at 13 points, showing that women more so than men preferred Obama. So we can maybe take that to mean that they're also paying attention to his economic plan.
But is that so different from what we've had in the past? I mean, so we could say that that's one of the things I've been asking myself all the way through is how different is this from other elections? 6 weeks ago, if we'd had this program, I think I would have said, gosh, this looks, despite all the discussions of race, gender, all that, this is astonishingly like the previous elections. The country is split and very predictable. Yeah. All the red states and blue states were the same ones. It's only in the last 3 weeks that this has changed. So that 8% gap, that sounds like the previous gaps.
It's not inconsistent. I did see a poll where it was 13, but Clinton had almost 11-point gender gap when he won. So yeah. You're right. It's not inconsistent in terms of that particular gender gap. So I think the one thing is that I think the Republican Party and John McCain in choosing Sarah Palin as a running mate had hoped to shrink that gender gap, and that was not effective in that choice.
Well, that's a great transition to the next question.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Sure.
So I'd like you to talk about that, the nomination of Sarah Palin and how the strategy of what that was working. You've developed a concept in your book about femball.
Right.
So talk about that. What was the logic and the gender logic of was that the logic of nominating Sarah Palin?
Right. I mean, you know, it was funny because I think the initial reaction to her, to his choosing her was, oh, he's trying to woo Hillary Clinton supporters. And a lot of people were appalled by that, justifiably so. And that wasn't my initial response. My initial thought was, no, he's basically trying to not only shore up Republican women, but maybe woo a lot of undecided women who might be happy that he chose a woman. Also, women, if you look at polls and so on, women are generally seen as agents of change, as reformers, and certainly this is one of the main mantras of the McCain-Palin McCain-Palin campaign. And so I think he chose her in part so that he can make the claim to be a reformer, distance himself from the past 8 years of the Bush administration. And so I think that was in part his tactic. Of course, she's also a social conservative. Social conservatives were concerned about McCain, so I think all of those things helped. In terms of femball, basically the concept means conservatives appropriating the tactic of having women speak for causes and talk about women's interests. And so having a woman speak about Republican issues basically then says, look, Republicans care about women's interests. And so we are a party that cares about these interests. Then we can shrink the gender gap in that way.
Well, who does that work with? I mean, that was part of the strategy. Is that effective? Who does that mobilize, that strategy?
Well, early on, I mean, it not only mobilized Republican women and the base, which obviously it's not that they're not going to vote for McCain, but in this particular election, you want to get those people to actually go out and vote, because as the polls are starting to show McCain, you know, doing worse and worse over time, you want to make sure that people actually go out there and vote for him if you're a Republican, because that could actually make it worse for him. Also, there was undecided women voters who initially were pretty happy, and men as well, actually. Men actually had more favorable opinion of her than women early on. And so I think initially there was a positive response to her. I think the concept of Sarah Palin is a little bit more positive than Sarah Palin herself, because she hasn't proven to be a particularly strong candidate.
So you think that the decline, her decline, is an attribute of her, then, not it's she who's running into trouble, not the femball strategy?
Right. I think the femball strategy actually might have worked a little better had he picked a candidate who was a little bit stronger, a little bit more prepared, probably a little bit more aware of national political issues.
Or perhaps if the McCain campaign had handled their candidacy differently. I mean, as you talk about in femball, it's letting women speak for their causes. The primary, perhaps, tactical mistake that the McCain campaign has made is not letting Governor Palin speak on her own behalf, except in very few circumstances that are very controlled. And if there's any second guessing about this nomination, a lot of that is in the wraps that they've kept her under.
Well, what do you think of that? Is that plausible?
I don't know that the fact that she's a woman was the key factor in the decision. For example, the short list of other candidates he was looking at that I had heard about was not exclusively women at all. And I think the reform issue is certainly one that McCain had intended to campaign on.
Right.
And I think what's fallen apart is not so much the press on Palin, but the economy deteriorating.
Right.
And I see a pretty strong correlation between the economy going down and the McCain-Palin prospects with them.
Right. I mean, I think that's absolutely true. But McCain-Palin had just as much of an opportunity as Obama-Biden to respond in a way to the economy that was appealing to people. So obviously their strategies aren't working in terms of responding to the economy.
A poor economy always hurts the incumbent.
Right.
And
right.
McCain would like to claim that he's not the incumbent,
right.
but that seems to be the way people are regarding him to some degree.
Yes.
Well, no, I think that's an interesting point, right? What's the classic? There are these objective predictors of an election that have nothing to do with the personality, the strategy,
right.
the misery index, but things are bad, people. And so is this sort of predictable? The economy's gone down, and so the incumbent is getting blamed. What do we know about that?
I mean, that is the strongest predictor in models of the
right.
election. But I think so much of this economic collapse was new and different. It's posed a lot of risk, right? Both candidates had to cast very tough votes
right.
on this perceived bailout of Wall Street plan. And they spent a lot of the last debate explaining that vote and then trying to help out Main Street, trying to out-populist each other. And so they've had their opportunities to reshape how they're viewed on the economy.
Yeah, right. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, obviously, McCain isn't the incumbent, but of course tied to the incumbent administration, which he, you know, grossly tried to distance himself from in the final debate. But, you know, as you said, they both had a chance to actually respond to this package in Congress and to maybe, you know, shape themselves as agents of change. And I think Obama's obviously had the opportunity to do that much more so than McCain, in part.
Well, that is a really fascinating thing among the McCain campaign. I thought when he picked Governor Palin that it was an effort. They say it's an effort to mobilize the base, but I thought it was an effort to strengthen his brand. I'm a maverick.
Yeah.
He understood early on, in fact, I think that's why he got nominated, that this is an unpopular president. Anybody associated as a Republican part of that president was going to be in trouble. Mm-hmm. I'm the maverick. I can run a maverick campaign. See, I've picked a maverick. That proves it. Now, why isn't that working? That doesn't seem to be working.
Well, he didn't preposition himself as an outsider on the financial issues, and he's trying to bring up Fannie and Freddie now, but mm-hmm. that wasn't something we heard him talking about 6 months ago. I think he was gambling a little bit on things getting better. And didn't really have a plan in place for riding the anti-incumbent wave such as it's
right.
developing.
Do you want to comment on that? You brought up Fannie and Freddie, so I'm going to ask you a question about it. That is an interesting thing as I've been following this, is that the Republicans are talking about Fannie and Freddie, and the Democrats are not. Well, you want to comment on that? Is that how would you evaluate, if you were one of those fact checkers or whatever, what would you say about blaming the whole thing on Fannie and Freddie? Remember, the logic is the Democrats supported Fannie and Freddie. Barney Frank, he supported it, so he's the head of the House Finance Committee. So this is a way of saying it's all the result of Fannie and Freddie, which the Democrats pushed because it helps these poor and minority candidates, which are they. What is your evaluation?
Well, if I were the fact checker, I'd have to split the difference. I mean, there's no question that Fannie and Freddie were not the only cause of what happened. The most egregious loans were not made by Fannie and Freddie or didn't go through Fannie and Freddie. But on the other hand, I think there's a pretty good case that they were part of what was going on, certainly in the initial phase. And they accumulated a lot of debt, a whole lot of mortgages that they guaranteed that Congress didn't provide for sufficient capital and regulation to make sure they could be good for those guarantees. And the result is now $5 trillion in obligations have basically been assumed by the federal government from Fannie and Freddie alone. Mm-hmm. So they're part of the problem. They're certainly not all of the problem.
What some of this complex discussion shows is it's really hard from the average voter's viewpoint to figure out who's to blame in this. Right now, voters seem to be falling back on blaming the party in power, but it's such a complex issue that I think it gives opportunities for both candidates to show some leadership and possibly shake things up in the next 3 weeks.
Well, say something about the politics of the future in a way. I mean, some of this, the politics of regulation is very interesting, this because that's part of the debate. What should we do to make sure to fix this stuff, make sure it doesn't happen again? What kind of regulations do we need? How is that playing itself out, do you think? I mean, if you thought we needed more regulation, which party would be more likely to do it?
Well, I think we're going to see more regulation of the financial sector, regardless of who's in power. Mm-hmm. It just has to happen. And I think it's important to emphasize that it's not so much that we deregulated mm-hmm. as that there were financial innovations and new institutions came up and started playing by new rules. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have an apparatus in place to supervise them. There wasn't even an agency responsible for many of these institutions. And so it's not that we changed the rules of the game, but the game changed on us, and so we've got to adapt the rules. I think that's inevitable, mm-hmm. who's ever in power. I think you can criticize the current administration and the Federal Reserve for not being on the ball on that issue sooner. Mm-hmm. I think they were a little surprised by just the magnitude of the problem we got into so quickly. But I think now that we're here, we're going to see changes, and we need to see changes.
Mm-hmm. And I think what we see over American history is this general American ethos in favor of the free market and a political system that makes it hard to regulate. Mm-hmm. But when we have financial collapses, you see regulation of railroads in the 19th century, massive federal regulation of the economy after the Great Depression. Depending on how bad things get, this could open the opportunity for a major re-regulation.
You know, in general, getting back to the gender gap, if you look at polls of surveys of men and women in terms of these kinds of issues, women generally tend to be more comfortable with those kinds of issues, with government involvement in regulation and social programs and those kinds of things. And so I think that might matter in the long run as well for candidates.
Well, so one of the interesting things, we've had person versus party, right? There's McCain has presented himself, his strategy is, I'm a good person. And Obama's, you know, pushing that, no, you're a Republican. What's the best predictor of how somebody's likely to be? If you're a voter, what should the voter do if they want, they know what they want, and how should they pick? Do you pick person or party?
Well, I think, as we were saying, people know what they don't want more than what they do want. They don't want what's been happening so far, and that's been working against McCain, whether he's a Republican or a maverick or whatever.
I think we need to all. I think party generally is a strong cue when people vote. But if we remember the mantra of the Clinton campaign, it's the economy, stupid. And I think that's what's going to overwhelmingly matter in this election.
Right. And presidential campaigns are really, this is the one campaign where we have the opportunity to really evaluate people and get to know them and not just have to rely on the shortcut of party. And what you see is, no matter what the party trend is, you see people doing better or worse than their party because at the presidential level because folks can get to know them. And I think both candidates have realized that and made a pitch for themselves as well as their party.
So you would interpret that McCain's difficulties in the polls right now are because people aren't at least the swing voter or aren't terribly liking what they're seeing.
He's doing a whole lot better than anyone else in the Republican Party. I mean, he may be losing to Barack Obama, but he's beating everybody else in the Republican Party and in some ways has run a fairly strong campaign.
Because of the maverick reputation stuff.
And his personal story.
His personal story, yeah.
Yeah, I think so, but I think I think that's true. He's doing better than some Republicans, although at this point, that's not a very high bar in this particular election. So I think he's run into some trouble, in part because of his personality. But again, I think you're right about, you know, the economic issue really being salient here as well. So there are clearly a number of factors.
Well, in a month, we're going to know, is it the economy stupid, which was the phrase of 20 years ago? We have this again, and we're going to find out real soon. Thank you very much. This has been very interesting. That's it for this edition of The Body Politic. We'll be back next month to talk about the results of this historic election. Until then, read through your sample ballot, inform yourself on the issues, and be sure to vote on November 4th. I'm Peter Gurevich. Thank you, and good night.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.